Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hi, welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo, and well, for those of you that, well, enjoy history but like to know about the bad guys in life, well, we're going to be talking about some of those bad guys. And in fact, they are called the dime novel desperados. These are two brothers that made national history in the U.S. because of their behavior. And well, we always need bad guys to talk about, don't we? Well, we have a gentleman, John E. Horwitz, and this gentleman has done a tremendous amount of research on two dime novel desperados that really were bad guys in real life. And we're going to be discussing that with him. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And I want my audience to know about you. You are a distinguished professor emeritus at Western Illinois University. You've done a lot of writing, and you have really had a passion for history. You've written about bootleggers. You have done all kinds of things. What do you think caused you to get bitten by this bug that will cause you to go into libraries, deal with dusty papers, and research people that are unknown? I mean, I didn't have a clue about the notorious Maxwell brothers. Why do you have such a curiosity about these people?
Well, that's a good question. Some people are driven to do that kind of thing. I always have been. I've worked in two fields, both literary studies and history here in the Midwest. So my couple dozen books are all about the Midwest in one way or another. And I'm just very intrigued by trying to recover perspectives by authors and situations, circumstances, fascinating people from the past, especially those that the present-day folks don't know very much about.
Well, we're going to be tripping back in our time machine to the 1800s to two outlaws. And these were the Maxwell brothers. How in the world did you find out about the Maxwell brothers? I mean, I'm not a big cowboy or Western fan. My grandfather was. He just absolutely loved to watch every Western on television and just thoroughly enjoyed rooting for the good guys out there destroying the bad guys. And, of course, on television, you'll see all of these old, old Westerns. Did they ever make a movie about the Maxwell brothers?
No, they were actually forgotten within a couple decades after they were nationally famous. Back in the early 1880s, for example, they were as well known across the country as Billy the Kid, virtually as well known as Jesse and Frank James for a period of time. But they, unlike those other figures who have become increasingly famous and have had many books done on them, many films made about them, the Maxwells were forgotten, but they were very, very famous in their own time.
Now, they really had done some interesting stuff. Give us a little bit about their background, because you have a statement in the first part of your book, in the preface, and I'm going to quote it exactly.
Okay.
You said, the Maxwell saga reminds us that identities are deeply related to cultural values and social conditions. Individuals become who they are partly because of where they live, who they know, and what they experience or struggle with. Now, I would agree with you there. I think a lot of it has to do with our character, too, as an individual. But what was the world like for these two? They were brothers. What were their ages? What kind of an environment did they come from? Give us a little bit of the inside tack on that.
Okay. The Maxwells were the sons of a tenant farmer who came west from Pennsylvania to Ohio, didn't do well in Ohio, came to Illinois, and drifted around from place to place, as so many tenant farmers did, renters, that is to say, in the 19th century. You know, our knowledge of the past in the 19th century is focused mostly, of course, on people who were successful, because those successful people who became successful, farmers and landowners who went into towns and became shopkeepers or lawyers or whatever, are, of course, the people about whom the histories, the county histories, the state histories, were later written. But we forget that in many places, as many as one out of three people was a renter, was somebody who wasn't doing well, didn't own their own land, was struggling from harvest to harvest to make a go of it. And so a lot of these people failed. They went back to where they came from. They really were living on a starvation level sometimes. It was a very hard time in what they called the West, which at that time included everything really from Ohio further west. So the Maxwell family was one of the families of that kind. So the two young men, Ed Maxwell and his younger brother Lon, grew up in that kind of situation, very impoverished. Not only impoverished, but there was a huge social class prejudice in the 19th century. So they were also disrespected, looked down upon. They had that kind of thing to contend with to begin with.
Now, you make a comment here that I think is very important, because at that time frame, now we have to, I'm going to mention this, that they were Caucasian. And in that same time frame, you had discrimination against blacks. It was horrific. You had it against anybody from the outside. It wouldn't make any difference if they were Irish or Catholic.
That's right.
And Chinese, didn't make any difference. There was a very distinct caste system, if you will, and I'm using that word because I think it is a very, very appropriate. And it was an economic caste system. So we were very much in this country like the mindset of those in Europe. And when you think about our original history, we came from Europe. A lot of people came from Europe, brought that European hierarchy of economic status with them. And so what you're describing, and please correct me if I'm misunderstanding anything, but what I think you're describing in this book is an awareness that this was there. And we shift over it, like you say, giving access to those that were very successful. But it's the truth that when you're in that low class, or when you were on the poor side of the tracks, or whatever terminology you want to use, then you were looked down upon. You were trash. They would have been put in my husband's background, because he came from the South, it would have been called like the white trash section.
Well, sure. In one sense, of course, America was never as bad as Europe in terms of social class consciousness, and we were a more fluid society. Everybody knew, and that's why they came here, and that's why they came west, that you could rise. But nevertheless, even though that was true, and many people did, there was also what you just described, and this social class prejudice, socioeconomic, and especially people who were on the bottom, very poor people, people who were not landowners, were disadvantaged in many ways, looked down upon, they didn't get an even break, there wasn't social services for them, and so it was a very hard situation for those kinds of people, and we tend to forget that.
I agree, we do. Now, their family bounced around, like you said, mom and dad, very hard life, very, very hard life. And unlike today, we have so many more opportunities. Then you could travel for hundreds of miles before you saw a human being, and to find food, to have it. We didn't have 7-Elevens then. So you had that marginal life existence that was so tough. Now, they started getting into trouble. Tell us a little bit about Ed and Lon, their personality types, and who was the instigator and sort of planner of the two.
It was the older brother, Ed, and let me say that their saga really begins with Ed, who's working as a young man. He's about 20 years old. He's an impoverished, disrespected, hired hand working for a farmer, which meant that at that time you'd work 14 hours a day, 6 days a week. You'd make maybe $15 or a little better than that, maybe, if you're lucky, a month. And that was very low, even for that time. And there were complaints, in fact, from people about how low that standard was and how difficult it was for people. So he's living on that level, and he steals a suit of clothes from a clothing store. Now, a modern judge would say to a person, a young person like that, don't do that, would lecture him, would tell him to report to an officer of the court X number of times, would tell him maybe to do some community service for a while, and they try to straighten that young person out. Instead, they sent Ed Maxwell to a horrific prison, Illinois State Penitentiary at Joliet, for a year. And Illinois State Penitentiary, you lived in a little cubicle that was made out of stone, 3 feet wide, 7 foot deep, 7 feet tall, completely stone except for the front door, which is bars, of course. And there was a silence rule. You couldn't talk to anyone else. You had to work 11 or 12 hours a day in the shops, 6 days a week. It was a brutal place where prisoners were sometimes beaten. And so it was a horrific place. And it simply, of course, caused criminality because it caused so much resentment and upsets anyone with the slightest psychological problem. And, of course, many lawbreakers have neurotic problems anyway. Those problems are going to get worse in that kind of environment. So by the time Ed comes out, he's more resentful than ever and gets with his younger brother, Lon, who's just a teenager, and the two of them start a career in outlawry, which means horse stealing, which means robbing people, robbing and burglarizing farmhouses and so on. That's how they get into the outlaw business and make a Western Illinois name for themselves.
Now, a point that I thought was very significant in your book is that in the later 1800s, actually, well, by 1860, the frontier, as is so often dramatically described, had virtually disappeared.
The frontier tends to disappear when the railroad comes through.
Right.
Because once you can get in and out of an area rather conveniently, you can ship things out or get things shipped in. The frontier, which is really characterized by isolation more than any other single thing, the frontier is gone. So the railroads come through in the Illinois area, for example, in the 1850s especially, and the more of them come in the 1860s. So really, that's the end of the frontier. However, this is still the West. It's still talked of as the West, and it is still the West in many, many ways. It's not called the Midwest until almost the turn of the century, as a matter of fact.
Now, you bring out the point that at this time, when these young men were growing up, and when I read it, I made a note in the book saying, gee, this sounds like history is repeating itself today. There was a lot of stuff going on that was a very rowdy type of environment among the young people. There was a concern. Family units had dissipated. There was just such a big change in the environment of communities because people were mobilizing. They were coming out to the West. A lot of things had changed. There
right.
had been, you know, the Civil War effect and the,
yes.
all these overlapping things. And I think to myself, my goodness, we are repeating ourselves to a degree because in this generation, it's one of the biggest themes that people are talking about. Well, here we are in the 1800s, and they were going through that big time. Young people were running away from home, joining the circus, trying to figure out where they could go. Families were in migration, saying, where can we go to have a better life? Again, so similar to things that are going on today, not just in the U.S., but in different parts of the world. So this is an ongoing thing. But in
yes.
the 1800s, how was it different?
Well, it was different in a certain sense. Of course, the families were very strongly bonded in lots of ways. Communities were very tightly knit in many ways. But what you just said was true. As I point out, it was a world of, in the mid-19th century, of destabilizing westward movement, frustrating failure for lots of people, extreme poverty, frontier rowdyism. Whenever you have an undeveloped culture, you're going to have a lot of drinking and rowdyism. and conflict over civil war issues, both during the war in the earlier 1860s and directly after the war, because there was a lot of pent-up bitterness as a result of the war. Many places, of course, there was conflict within the community over support of the North versus support of the South.
Mm-hmm.
So you have all these kinds of things, prejudice against landless workers that we've just mentioned, escalating crime. In fact, I mentioned that the post-Civil War era is really the first great crime wave in American history. You and I know that the next great crime wave is really the Roaring Twenties and leading into the 30s, the Prohibition era.
Yeah.
And, of course, Prohibition had much to do with it, the rise of bootlegging, that sort of thing. People are familiar with the lawbreaking that greatly escalated at that time. But the first great crime wave was in that post-Civil War era, and the war itself had much to do with it because it increased poverty, increased stress, destabilization on the home front. Men came home after being macho males, soldiers, mm-hmm. capable of shooting people and so forth, and then brought their guns, and so you had an increase in violent crime. So, and there's no accident, in other words, that Billy the Kid, Sam Bass, John Wesley Hardin, the James Gang, all sorts of other outlaws arose in that post-Civil War era and continued through the 1870s. In fact, making it worse, the 1870s was one of our great Depression eras, starting in 1873 and running through the decade. In fact, the worst depression in American history up to that time. And so that made things very bad also, and it continued on into the 1880s.
A significant point that you brought out is that the justice system, and I'm quoting from your book, failed most of the time during that time period. And you especially pointed out, and this was in Fulton County, that most men, and I'm quoting from your book, in Fulton County feared and resented authority and also felt that dependence on a lawman undermined the assertion of one's manhood. It was a sign of weakness. Consequently, they were unable to employ the justice system to force compliance with a common moral standard regarding assault and murder. And you talk about this aspect, how a particular wealthy person, rancher, would go out and murder somebody in cold blood, and a jury would be brought in. Everybody would acquit him, even though they knew he was guilty.
Indeed.
And this affected Ed and Lon. Of course, Ed had been in prison, and he came out of that prison experience with an attitude, and then he was seeing and observing a lot of things. So his attitude is, what have I got to lose? I'm not going to win no matter what I do. And he was intelligent. Both he and his brother were very intelligent young men.
Yes, that's right. I try to get the reader to look inside the selfhood, the identity, the mind of Ed and Lon Maxwell, rather like Truman Capote did back in the 1960s with In Cold Blood. Yes, these people were doing wrong, but after all, the point is we need to understand them. What was driving these people? And it isn't just a matter of social conditions, however harsh they were for certain people, and it's a rich complex of other things. Of course, there are genetic predispositions in people. Some people have a temper. Every mother knows that little babies can have a temper at the age of one. Show that their sister or brother doesn't show. So you've got genetic factors, you've got psychological factors. If you don't get along with your father, your mother doesn't favor you, other things happen to you, I'm sorry, but those have a deep lasting impact on lots of people. So you've got psychological issues. And when Ed was small, and Lon was even smaller, just a few years old, their father was gone, to make matters worse, away at the Civil War. And here's the mother trying to struggle to keep food on the table, and it was a very, very difficult time. And beyond that, there's the factor, and you were getting at it, of cultural beliefs, really. One of the things that people don't look hard enough at in terms of what causes our behavior is cultural beliefs, which scholars call myths, and scholars use the word myth not to mean a fable or a falsehood, but quite the opposite. A myth is a deeply held truth believed in by the people of a culture and often told in story form. We love heroes that express what we believe in. America, for example, has the myth of individualism, like all Americans are individuals. In fact, you and I know that many Americans are conformists.
Mm-hmm.
Despite our freedom, to be otherwise, but they're conformists. But nevertheless, we believe in individualism. Americans certainly can be individual. We cherish it as a deeply held belief, and we love to see movies. We love to read books about people who show their individualism, who stand up for what they believe in. All right, that's a cultural myth or a deeply held belief. But another one was manliness. This notion, which is still around today, but was very prevalent in the 19th century, that if you're a man worth respecting, you assert yourself. The willingness to be violent when some excuse for doing so arises is good. And masculine honor, in fact, demands confrontation and revenge for injury or insult. This is sometimes called also by scholars the code of the West, but it was also prevalent in the South, prevalent here in the what used to be the West, the Midwest as well. And so think of all the Western, you talk about your father's interest in Westerns, think of how we have embodied that myth of manliness mm-hmm. in our Westerns, where to be a real man and to be respected, you got to stand up to the slightest insult. You got to just call somebody on it, be ready to hit them, be ready to shoot them, or whatever. And that was very prevalent in the 19th century. Ed Maxwell built that into his own character. Myths or deeply held beliefs in our culture get built into our sense of identity. And that was one that had a big impact on Ed. And so he was always wanting to stand up for himself, to show people that he was somebody, that he wasn't just nothing. And that was true in the cultural areas where he was raised. You mentioned Fulton County. And as a result of that, too, the justice system did not work. Mm-hmm. People would be charged with a crime, and that is, somebody would think he was insulted by someone or put down by someone, he'd call him on it, he'd draw a knife or a gun and start a fight with somebody, and if he killed the man, then he'd simply go to court and say, well, the guy disrespected me. What do you expect? I'm a man of honor. He started the fight anyway. Of course, he's dead and he can't say anything different. But he started the fight, and therefore, I'm a man of honor. And it was sort of self-defense. And they would have a not guilty verdict time after time after time after time in those situations. So it took us a while to have our justice system be able to operate effectively in cases like that.
Amazing. Now, you brought out a point that Ed had this escapism into the mythology, and I was intrigued with how he became the banditti, as you pronounced it, mm-hmm. or you stated in the book, but he really did start to believe the myth. And of course, reporters then, as so many times they are today, they're not interested in the facts. They'll go and they'll sensationalize everything.
So exactly.
He then became, along with his brother, because they had daring escapes where they robbed somebody. So people were getting all of this information, and they were the bad guys. And so it was quite exciting. He had a value to his life. And even though he was so intelligent, he didn't want to use his intelligence in a positive way, and perhaps there wasn't the option for him. I don't know. I wasn't there. But from what you present is the fact that he really enjoyed the persona that was being given to him by the press. And
exactly.
He used it for everything it was worth. And then the dime store novels came about. Tell us about the dime store novels.
Let me correct you. Dime novels.
Dime novels.
The dime novels were the first paperback books. And they were started in New York about 1860. And they were fairly slim, 30, 40-page long paperbacks about exciting figures, Buffalo Bill, Kit Carson, and so on, including fictional characters, tales of adventure and excitement in the far west or fighting Indians or who knows what. But they were very, very popular. They sold across the country, and it just so happened that by the very early 1880s, in fact, in 1881, you begin to see the outlaw hero emerge in dime novels, which is to say you get the first of these early paperback books focused on figures who were, in fact, outlaws, and they become the central figures. And, in fact, in 1881, Jesse James, the first dime novel on him, Billy the Kid, the first novel on him, and Ed and Lon Maxwell, the first dime novel about them, all appear in 1881, and that's really the beginning of the outlaw hero in American literature, in a sense. And after that, there were a lot of dime novels about them and about at least a handful of other outlaws. And again, this puts Ed and Lon Maxwell in a rather elite group, a rather small group of all the hundreds and hundreds of outlaw figures in American history who ever became the subjects of those dime novels that circulated. In fact, some of them were not even a dime. Some of them were just a nickel, but they were very widely circulated in the country through the rest of the 19th century and into the early 20th.
You have some phenomenal photography that you have reproduced in the book. How old were they when they were caught? Now, they were interviewed. I mean, you have in here how Ed didn't think he was a bad guy or immoral. He just felt he was bold, and he was sort of a Robin Hood in a way, although I don't know that he gave back to very many people. But
right.
Just, you know, hey, I'm not a bad guy. I'm just doing what I have to do. So he was totally in love with this fabricated myth and talked to reporters. I mean, this is just brazen. But
right.
Hey, he was right there, and the reporters were saying, hey, I'm going to take this and send it back to my home office, and this is really great stuff, and here you got the dime novel. But you have this. How were they caught, and what happened?
They what made them national figures is they were sent to prison, both of them to Illinois State Penitentiary, after being caught as robbers and horse thieves. When they got out, they drifted into Wisconsin. Actually, the younger brother started to go straight. He worked as a logger, got married to a lovely young gal who was going to have a baby, and they were he was fitting in, and he was really changing his life. His older brother Ed gets out. Ed isn't reformed. Ed goes to Wisconsin and convinces Lon, for one reason or another, to do one more robbery. He perhaps because he asserted that he was owed money by a particular company in Stillwater, Minnesota, where he had been for a period of time. Lon goes with him. Unfortunately, they get seen as they commit this robbery, and they're outlaws on the run again. And they have a gunfight in the summer. In July of 1881, they meet in the street of a small town called Durand, Wisconsin. They meet in the street two sheriffs from two different counties, actually who were brothers, the Coleman brothers, Charles Coleman, who was a recent sheriff, a former sheriff of Pepin County, and his younger brother, Milton Coleman, who was an undersheriff or deputy sheriff of adjacent Dunn County. Those two sheriff figures in the street. So it's a brothers against brothers gunfight, really very much like the gunfight at the O.K. Corral, which is so utterly famous to Americans, mm-hmm. involving the Earp brothers and the Clantons, if you remember. But in this particular case, the outlaws win, because Ed and Lon Maxwell were crack shots. They dropped those two sheriffs right in the street, and that touches off the largest manhunt for outlaws in American history, really, meaning 19th century outlaw figures. It goes to several states. It lasts months. Includes Minnesota, eastern Iowa, down into Illinois they're chasing them, Missouri. They eventually catch Ed months later in November out in Nebraska and bring him back to Wisconsin for trial. And, of course, by that time he's an utterly famous figure because the killing of the two sheriffs has gotten them national attention, and the huge chase involving some 20 or more posses has gotten coverage from the New York Times and Washington, Philadelphia, and other newspapers. And so Ed is a famous figure. And as you say, fortunately for me, he gave lots of interviews at that time when he was captured. And, of course, that helped me reconstruct his story. But he's brought back to Wisconsin and lynched. He's lynched in broad daylight because the people there were so angry for the shooting. And that, in turn, touches off a nationwide discussion of lynching. Again, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Atlanta Constitution, the Chicago newspapers, St. Louis, are all commenting on the lynching of Ed Maxwell and the problem of law and order in the United States. And so it touches off a huge discussion in the newspapers of that. Some newspapers actually standing up for lynching and saying lynching is what people deserve, but most of them, fortunately for us, condemning it, saying, no, you can't do this in America. This is not the solution to anything. It only makes things worse. But it's a huge, huge discussion.
Well, and also I have to mention that with the younger brother Lon, I know we're almost out of time, the younger brother Lon, there's a love story here. And he was married to a lovely woman named Fanny, and she ends up dying. I wouldn't want to deprive anybody of the opportunity of reading about this very special, special love story that's in here. You have so much wonderful information, John, and it was such a delight to be able to review your material. What is your website so people can go and check all of this out?
My, I'll give them my email address. They can go to a, if they want to send something to me personally, they can send it to J-E hyphen and my last name, H-A-L-L-W-A-S, at WIU.edu. And they can go also to the Western Illinois University web page and look under speeches. And I've recently given a talk that's already posted on the web just last week called Doing Justice to Outlaws, the Writing of Dime Novel Desperados. And they can see that and, of course, print it out and so forth. But it's my own commentary on getting at the deep issues of what causes violent behavior in America and that kind of thing.
John E. Hollis has
right.
been my guest today. John, it has been a delight. Your book, Dime Novel Desperados, The Notorious Maxwell Brothers, is a tripping by the time machine of paper into the past that I think is absolutely, totally insightful and gives us another paradigm that enables us to see about how we have evolved, if you will, to where we are today. Thank you for being my guest.
My pleasure.
This is Donna Seabow. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment. Dime Novel Desperados, The Notorious Maxwell Brothers, my guest John E. Hollis. We'll be back in just a moment.
Do you want to lose weight? Do you deal with diabetes, high blood pressure, osteoporosis, or chronic pain? Do you want to know one of Dr. Perricone's 7 secrets to beauty, health, and longevity? Do you have 15 minutes a day to look and feel better? Then let me introduce you to TTAP, the workout that works. For the beginner or expert exerciser, learn from physical training specialist Teresa Tapp how, in just 15 minutes a day, you can burn fat and sugar, build strong bones and muscles, and lose inches fast with no equipment or jumping. Visit the TTAP website, ttap.com, or call 1-800-342-0717 to learn how. That's TTAPP.com. We'll help you lose inches, look good, and feel fabulous at TTAP. 1-800-342-0717, ttap.com.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Seabow. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Hi, this is Donna Seabow, and telephone lines are now open, so give me a buzz at the following telephone numbers if you'd like for me to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. Here they are, 877 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. Canadians, 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. Also, 530-876-3222. That's 530-876-3222. And all I need from you is your first name or your initial. After that, let me tell you what I perceive, and then you're welcome to ask a question about anything that you like. Again, that's 877-876-5227, 888-815-9756, or 530-876-3222. By the way, I want to thank those of you that I met at the Boeing Parapsychology Expo this past weekend. It was a delight to be able to chat with you and to hear your comments about the show and how you're enjoying it. It's just always such a pleasure to do appearances publicly and to be able to interact with people. And so many times they'll say, well, I get a chance to see what you look like. I see you up on your webpage, and I know there's a picture there, but it's nice to be able to meet you in person. So I want to thank those of you. And as always, no matter where I go, I have authors that come up to me and say, oh, I want you to know about my new book. So we've got some new material that I'm reviewing that came from some of the people at this public appearance on this last Saturday, and oh, it's just some really good stuff. So we've just got so many talented people in this world, and it's such a joy to be able to have the opportunity to bring them to the listen to the airwaves here where you can listen. And I want to let you know about an activity that is coming up. I'm going to be giving a broadcast this week from TTAP. Yes, TTAP Retreat in Tampa, Florida, and I'm going to be there with Teresa and a number of other people. There's going to be about 100 other individuals there, and I'm going to be able to share with you this Thursday some people's comments and what they've gone through and how they've been able to do better using this wonderful fitness program that I have become very enamored of because I've seen such a change in myself. So I invite you to share with your friends that they will hear the absolute amazing stories of people, and I'll be right there on site with them in Tampa, Florida. And then this microphone will be traveling down to San Francisco, and I want to tell you, I have been making an error when I gave the announcement. We're going to be there in San Francisco on the 17th and 18th for the Wisdom Festival. I thought it was the 19th as well, but it isn't. It's the 17th and 18th. And I know we've got a caller, and we'll be going to that caller in just a moment. But I want to tell you, I'm going to be appearing at Fort Mason on the 17th and 18th, and we are going to be there. I'll be speaking, and you will be able to see all kinds of wonderful things. And we've got products coming in from different parts of the world. We've got people, speakers coming in from different parts of the country, like myself. And you want to go to wisdomfestival.com. There you're going to find out about the prices. If you buy tickets online, you get a discount. You'll find the hours. You'll see the schedule of everything that's going on. And, of course, while you're there, you're going to be able to just walk through all of the exhibits and meet all kinds of people. This is a wonderful environment for you to interact with if you have questions about lots of things. And I'm going to be there too, so be sure you stop by my booth and say hello. But that is coming up in October, which is right around the corner. My goodness, it's so hard to believe. This year is just zipping by. Well, let's go to our first caller of the day. I want to welcome you to the show. First name or initial, and where are you calling from?
Hello, can you hear me clearly?
Well, I can hear you, sir, yes, but you may need to speak a little bit louder.
Okay,
what's your first name or initial?
Yes, my name is Ryan, R-Y-A-N, and I'm calling from St. Louis, Missouri.
St. Louis, Missouri.
Yes.
I hope I have the opportunity to come to that beautiful part of the country. I just think it's absolutely awesome. Of course, I think so many places in the U.S. are absolutely awesome, and I've yet to visit them. One day I will. But let's get down to business with you, Ryan. The first thing that is coming into my mind is don't play games with your head. I want you to be able to deal with facts, not fantasy. There's a place for fantasy in life, but you have come to a crossroad, And there are environments that you have been within that you have taken little bits and pieces from, and you're putting together a collage for yourself because you're trying to, for all intents and purposes, restructure your life in a particular way. Now, this is excellent. However, you must sift out the make-believe. And the reason you must is that you're coming to terms with certain aspects of belief patterning from the past. And it's as if you're having to look at things for what they really are, instead of what somebody else may have superimposed upon your mind as a belief system. You need to look at what you want in your belief system and not carry forward what is perhaps garbage from the past. And it's amazing because subconsciously we absorb so much stuff. But you have been regurgitating a lot of apprehensions, confusions. They have been flooding your mind to the point where you just almost at times get so emotional. You go, what's wrong with me? Am I going wacky? No, you're not going wacky. What's happening is that you as an individual are recognizing certain things that you know you want in your space. What you're not understanding is that the subconscious is being purged, and so all of this old stuff is coming up. And there's a part of you that does not know how to release this. And what you need to understand, and this is something a mentor taught me many, many years ago, when you let go of an old belief, when you're tired of it, when it no longer has value, you need to put something in its place. For example, if you have always had a belief that you were incompetent about riding a bike, this is a ridiculous example, but I'll give it to you anyway. You're incompetent, you can never ride a bike. So maybe you've gone along all this time, and then you meet somebody, and you go, oh, wow, I'd love to learn how to ride a bike. So while you're on the bike, you are regurgitating this statement made by someone, you are incompetent, you cannot ride a bike. Maybe they use different words, but that's there. Then all of a sudden you find yourself saying, yes, I can, yes, I can, yes, I can. And then you go and you do it. Well, that purges out the, gee, I'm incompetent. But you may have a remnant of that still floating around in the subconscious. So maybe the next time you get on the bike, you don't feel so safe. And maybe you have an experience and you go, gee whiz, I don't feel safe here. I guess I really am not incompetent. I am incompetent, excuse me. But instead of doing that, you say, wait a minute, I am competent. I rode it the other day just fine. This was an experience. Maybe I had a very close encounter of a bicycle kind, but now I know I can do this. I'm going to go do it anyway. And you become very proficient at riding the bike. But you had to replace that belief in incompetency with the actual action of showing you were competent, even though you had an uncomfortable situation. But you could have gone either way. Do you see my point?
Well, I'm glad that I am aware of the process that you're talking about. And, definitely. I'm definitely see your point as to where these patterns that have served their purpose are now coming up to surface to be dealt with and to be reanalyzed to explore new potentials.
No question about this. So this... You have to have due diligence here. You have to, in other words, I want you to be consciously aware that when this trash, mind trash, comes up, look at it, don't give it any energy, and just say, that is very interesting to observe, and then move into what you really want. It's okay to have that come up. In fact, it's doing you a favor. It's not bad, because then you take the positioning of personal power, and that is significant. But it's only when we're consciously aware of it, only when we're consciously aware of it, that it reinforces what we want, not what we don't want. And so we're going to take a break in just a minute. Will you stay with me, Ryan?
Sure.
And then we'll take your question. We're talking with Ryan in St. Louis, Missouri. You're also going to have the same opportunity if you would like to take advantage of it. Give me a call at 877-876-5227 or 888-815-9756. We also have 530-876-3222. We're going to take a break for just a moment. We're going to come back, talk to Ryan, and I'd be delighted to light up your life, too. So don't go away. We're going to come right back.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Enter the magical world of God's Kiss.
Johnny finds himself at the entrance to a large open valley, framed by high mountains rich in the brown-red colors of the earth. He stands in awe, even a little fearful of the mountain's great size. After all, he's just a little boy and not very tall.
God's Kiss is a beautifully illustrated children's book about a young boy's journey into a valley with children and animals from all over the world. They are gathering together to experience the wonder of love and beauty that will affect their lives forever. A talking book audio narrated by the author Donna Sebo accompanies this wonderful storybook, creating a special magic all of its own. This book package makes a wonderful gift for those special children in your life ages 3 to 10. God's Kiss book and talking book audio are only $19.95 plus shipping and handling, and the author Donna Sebo will autograph and personalize your book if you request it. Call 800-872-8852. You can also order through Donna Sebo's website, www.delphiinternational.com. That 800 number again, 872-8852.
Hi, this is Donna. 877-876-5227, 888-815-9756. We're going to go back to Ryan. Ryan, what's your question for me today?
Yes, my question very simply would be, do you have any advice or suggestions how to move forward financially?
Well, that's an excellent question for you to ask because you're in a very stable patterning with money. And when I look at it, when you're saying you're wanting to move forward, the term I'm getting is aggressiveness. Now, that doesn't mean you go out and try to be like the Maxwell brothers that we were talking about in the first part of the program. That's not what I'm talking about. But it is an aggressiveness about your belief in your own capabilities and selling yourself to other individuals about your value. What kind of work are you involved with, Ryan?
I currently work at a guitar store.
What is it you'd like to do?
I would like to be a healer. That's what I would like to do. I would like to heal people and help with shifts in patterns, I guess, is an easy way to say it.
All right. Now, have you any college behind you at all?
No, not specifically.
All right. Let me encourage you to consider something. Let me encourage you to consider getting a BA in counseling. Now, that may seem a little bit overwhelming, but
a
I'd like for
what?
You...
I'm sorry?
A bachelor's in counseling.
Mm-hmm.
Then what I'd like for you to consider are those arenas of healing therapies that you could get an accreditation in. But the reason I recommend that you take this patterning is, one, you would have a credibility that would serve you well. Two, you would have the recognition of being qualified to be able to interact with people. Three, it would help you to organize a patterning of discipline that would serve you very well. And four, you would have the opportunity to do internship to see what level of involvement with people you would like. Now, the modalities of healing are as varied as the amount of individuals on this planet. But to become educated in a specific modality that you would have an interest in is going to serve you very well. So if music is something that is especially appealing to you, the arts. The modalities of using art in therapy, music in therapy, is absolutely phenomenal. The growth in these areas of scientific understanding is fabulous. So when you combine that along with the development of intuition, you have got a winning proposition, and it can make a phenomenal difference in your life. So that is what you would like to do. Know and recognize that right now you are in a store that is involved with music, and I would look at the research that you could do that would put you into that schooling environment. You're young enough to do it, go for it, so that you can see yourself expanding your financial base. So you're going to have a stability with money, and I think what you need to do is explore options that may enable you to have the financial support you need. Could be scholarships, it could be any number of things. And then that way you'd have assistance with your cost of schooling and make a commitment in that area. And I think your income would just explode after about 4 years. But it will be important for you to look, and this is separating myth from fact. And that's okay. This is a process you're going through. So I hope that you'll give it some interest here. I hope you'll give it some thought, explore it, and don't discount it. Because I'm seeing someone telling you, oh, you could go to this, or that, or so. You don't have to do that. But understand what you're going to want to have is credibility. And your education is going to give you that license of credibility that you wouldn't have otherwise. Does that help you?
Yeah, it makes sense. It works from a lot of different angles, and I think you're very accurate from a lot of them. And I do appreciate that.
Oh, you're more than welcome. You'll have to call me back and tell me what modality you decide you want to choose. But believe me, it is going to open your world in a phenomenal way. Meanwhile, go to your local library and check out any material you possibly can get on the music therapy aspect and also the artistic aspect. And I think you are going to find a wonderful world that will just open your mind, your eyes, your experience to a level where you're going to feel that you can do more to make a difference than you would have ever imagined. But you need to be around people who understand this and that you can learn from. I wish you well, Ryan.
Well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. How'd you learn about the show?
I just kind of ran across it by chance, actually. I was just watching a YouTube video and someone mentioned BBS Radio, and it was just, you know, one of those things that just kind of happened.
Well, I'm so pleased that you were able to hear the show today. Did you enjoy the guest?
Yes, I very much enjoy the whole discourse.
Oh, thank you. Well, you know, you can always let me know what you think about the shows, and be sure and tell your friends about it. And it's been a delight having you as a guest. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. This is Donna Siebel. We're out of time just about. So I know that I'm not going to be able to take another caller, but tomorrow we're going to be learning about money. Kim Snyder is going to be my guest. We're going to be learning about how one can be the family CEO. And let me tell you, you don't need to have a family to learn from Kim. This book is excellent. I was referring it to someone just this past Saturday who really has a knack for numbers and money, and I said, you've got to read this book because it's going to give you tools to work with. And that's what we need to do. That's what I think I like to bring to the table, to the airwaves, are just all of these wonderful people that have so much to offer to you, and you can take it or you can leave it, but without being able to know that these things are out there for you to have a chance to explore, how are you going to know? That's what education offers you, and that's what the joy of reading offers you, and also by listening to this show. And it's my pleasure to bring all these wonderful people right at the convenient level of your computer. This is Donna Siebel. We are out of time. Remember, always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. You don't need to be desperate. You don't need to feel like you have to be on the bottom rung of the ladder for your life. You remember, the ladder of opportunity is there for you to climb, but you're the only one that can put your foot on the rungs of that ladder and move up one at a time, or perhaps take four or five. But it's up to you, and this is a good day. A good day to take your place in life and to start moving up wherever you might be. Because, hey, there's no limits. That's right. This is Donna Sebo. Talk with you tomorrow. Same time, same place. Right here. BBSRadio.com. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.